I'm Al Stoller, and I'm sitting in for Haynes today on Earth Mysteries. Haynes asked me to fill in, and so I asked my friend Richard Hurley to come in. Richard has just published a book. Actually, I believe it just came out today, so this is brand new. It's called California and the Civil War. Richard, thanks for coming in.
Oh, pleasure to be here, Al.
We've been planning to do this for some time, so I'm glad this spot opened up, because spots are hard to find sometimes. And one thing I would like to know, there's so much California history, beyond just the Civil War, which all the stuff I didn't know about, and California's involvement, but California history in general. I have to admit that I did not get interested in history until well after high school, and I started reading books, and some of the authors were real interesting. I thought, oh, there's something here. Going way, way back, not as far back as I might go with geology, but way back, how did California come to be a Spanish possession?
Well, I think everyone's familiar with the story of Hernan Cortes and his...
Don't assume nothing.
Well, some very crazy Spaniards got loose in Central America and went around conquering enormous, well-organized, vibrant, advanced Indian civilizations. And they did it with a certain amount of bravado and steel and with a certain biological assistance. As you're probably aware, they introduced European diseases into this hemisphere with devastating results. So you had civilizations basically collapsing in front of the Spaniards before they actually had to engage with the actual acts of conquest. There was a Mexican, well, actually there was a Spanish, a Royal Spanish Government of Mexico that was in place and had been for a couple of centuries, and they had a very strong connection to the Catholic Church. And that's really the origin of California, is this proselytizing duty of the friars. Of course, the Spanish imperial government was interested in what's up north in this enormous continent that they sort of inadvertently conquered. And so there was a real politic element to the exploration.
And you say friars. Now, there are a number of different sects, is not the right word, but there are the Dominicans and the Franciscans and the Jesuits. Yeah. So the friars, does that denote one particular group of Catholics?
Well, in California's history, we're talking about Franciscans. The Jesuits were very influential politically, and they were actually kicked out of California at a certain point.
By the Franciscans?
Actually, by the Mexican government. The Mexican government in California. That's a tangled story, and I don't really want to go there because I'm not well-versed in it. But my understanding is that the padres who came up to California were Franciscans.
Right.
And that's why we have, St. Francis of Assisi, San Francisco. They really wanted to save souls. That's the good news. The bad news is that they brought together native peoples into very small communities, which constituted absolutely ideal vectors for introducing European pathogens. So the mortality rate in the old California missions was horrific. They were also stern disciplinarians, not by the standards of their day, but we would regard their treatment of the Indians as simply barbarous. So they had a terrible impact, and I do credit them with genuinely being interested. From their standpoint, they were saving these people from internal damnation, but from the standpoint of the Indian community, it was catastrophic. So the best estimates today put California's Indian population in excess of 300,000 people, with no industrial base. I mean, this is how lush California is. It's the happy place to live if you have a hunter-gatherer society.
Yeah, no farming either.
You have agricultural management. You manage the woods to a certain degree. You burn it off early to encourage the growth of certain food items and handy things. But no, you don't need agriculture. Why bother? You can just move the tribe to where the next set of crops are maturing or where the animals have migrated to. So the typical pattern, I mean, there are many patterns. The Indian community of California is remarkably diverse. And the first thing to understand about it is that we're talking about governments that are conducted at the village level. You would have a headman, and a headman might have sway over nearby villages, but the idea of large tribes that whites, they sort of naturally leap to the conclusion that, you know, the Indians are governed like the whites like to be governed. And so they were forever being surprised by the diffuseness, basically, of Indian government. So you'd make a treaty with, you know, the local headman, and you'd assume that everybody who speaks his language has just agreed to your treaty. But in fact, the man you've just talked with represents two villages, you know, in the next valley, and you're one valley over, and they've never heard of you, your treaty, or, you know, and don't particularly care for the headman that you signed with. So even though language tended to extend beyond individual villages, it wasn't an organizing principle. You know, it wasn't like French gathering the French together.
That was challenging, but we'll go into that.
I mean, that's another show.
So now Mexico becomes its own nation.
Right.
Yeah, tell us a little bit.
Okay, so they have their revolution to free themselves of Spanish royal authority. This is in the 1820s. And they found an interesting society. They get rid of slavery. Okay. Unfortunately, it's very chaotic. It's hard to even describe the tumult of early Mexican history. So a far-flung province like California effectively has no real link with Mexico City. The soldiers they never get paid. Okay, somebody sends out a bag full of gold to pay the handful of soldiers in California. It absolutely never gets here. Okay, the Northern Californian Mexican population is suspicious of the Southern California Mexican population. They have their own sort of mock battles, you know, and they threaten each other. Should the capital be at Monterey or should it be farther south? And so basically it's an independent state in all but name.
California is.
Yes. Mexico actually at one point sends a governor up here to try to straighten things out, and he is roundly rejected, you know, and just ignored. In fact, I think they even jailed the guy. This isn't my period, but let's just say that he did not succeed in his mission.
I guess it would be the state of Texas, but the Mexican state of Texas secedes from Mexico.
Right, right. So you have a strong independence movement in Texas that is Mexican-based. They don't want to be involved with Mexico City either. And so you have various factions in Mexico inviting Anglo settlers to come in and help them fight the Comanche, who are the people who are actually in charge of West Texas at this point. They have an enormous empire. And they're scary, you know. And so at first, the Mexican government, even in Mexico City, encouraged Anglo settlement until Anglo settlement started getting up into the tens of thousands. Okay, and then in 1835, a mixture, really, of Texans of Mexican descent and Anglo descent rebel against the Mexican government. And that creates the Independent Republic of Texas. And you can see that California headed right straight down the same path, except that it's a lot farther to walk to if you're an Anglo. We start getting mountain men over here, and you know they show up, and then you begin to get a trickle of Anglos, basically Americans. I mean, they were called Anglos by the Mexicans, but you know who knows? But they were white Northern Europeans for the most part, and they start showing up. And they, at first, conformed to the local community's rules. You had to be a Catholic to be a landowner here, and you were expected to convert, at which point you could enter into the local society pretty easily. There's a guy, Thomas Larkin, who's living in Monterey, who's married a Mexican woman and has done the conversion thing, and he's a prosperous trader in Monterey. But he's also an agent for the United States, and he's in communication with American officials. And many of the Anglo settlers, particularly in Northern California, retain their political allegiance to the United States. And as Mexico's rule weakens, the American presence becomes more assertive. So you have, finally, John Fremont going out west, ostensibly to go check out Oregon to make sure that American settlers can get to Oregon easily and colonize it so the British don't take it.
So we're in the early 1840s
here. Yes, yes, that's right. It's important to point that out. And he comes down to California because, you know, he's in the neighborhood. You know, he's up in Oregon and say, well, why not? Why don't I go down to California? At least this is the cover story. And so he ends up checking out California.
With his battalion of surveyors.
Yeah, surveyors in quotes. They're pretty heavily armed by surveyor standards, but he likes what he sees. And he goes back to Washington, and there is a very great deal of interest in California among the people who believed in manifest destiny. This phrase is really rocketing around Washington, largely because of Texas, the southern people, the southern leadership want to annex Texas as a slave state. They really are interested in the idea of expanding America westward, the United States westward. And Polk is elected president in 1846 on that platform. You know, he's supposed to be the fellow who implements manifest destiny. And he's very aware of California. In fact, you know, I can't prove this, but my guess is that the Mexican-American War was at least as much about California as it was about Texas. Texas was a fait accompli. Texas had entered the Union. But the port of San Francisco was a strategic asset of unimaginable value. You could put all of the navies in the world safely at anchor in the San Francisco Bay. And this had attracted attention from any country that was interested in any kind of commercial activity in the Pacific. So the French had contacted the Mexican government of California. They wanted to buy the port. The English were negotiating with Mexico City. They wanted the San Francisco Bay given to them in settlement for debt. And the Americans wanted the San Francisco Bay, period. And so Fremont goes back to Washington, and he reports on the situation in California. That there's a large active community of Americans who are interested in joining with the United States. Interestingly, there are a fair number of Mexicans who are also interested in switching. They realize that their relationship with Mexico City is not viable, and they are interested in forming an independent government. And there are some who favor an alliance with the British, some with the French, and some who are actually interested in working with the United States. So that's the situation when the Mexican-American War breaks out.
And Mid-1840s.
Yeah, 1846. And it was a worsening crisis. But, you know, to put the record absolutely straight, we took Monterey before there was a declaration of war. And given the time it takes news to get from one coast to the other, you have to assume that the commander of the American Pacific Squadron was aware that there was going to be a war, and that his job was to take the capital of California. He just got a little ahead of himself, that's all.
And as you say, it took like a week and a half for the Pony Express to go from
Yeah, and there's no Pony Express.
Yeah,
way before the Pony Express. So your actual time lag is months.
Oh.
Okay.
Oh.
And speaking of time lags, John Fremont has had a chance to, say, wander out this way again. And he's out here with another band of surveyors, in quotes, and he just happens to be in Sonoma at the time the Bear Flag Rebellion breaks out.
Bear Flag Rebellion. We all know what a bear flag looks like.
Yeah. Well, a bear flag looks like a sow, actually, if you see the original one. But it was the best attempt that the American settlers in Sonoma could come up with at the time. And they declared themselves an independent republic. So California was originally launched as a republic. But we're talking a matter of days between that rebellion and the seizure of Monterey. And then all of a sudden, the bear flaggers decide that, hey, what, you know what, let's actually become linked to the United States. And historians spend a lot of time trying to sort out, you know, who was plotting what when. But I think you can generally say that the American conquest of California was the American conquest of California, you know, however it was staged and whatever sequence things actually worked out in. And so that gives us the best port on the western northern hemisphere of America. So, you know, hey, that's good.
Okay, so that gets settled by a treaty.
Yes, Guadalupe Hidalgo. And 9 days before that treaty.
9 days.
9 days. While it's still Mexican California, this carpenter's over there in Coloma setting up a mill for John Sutter. You know where this is going. and he notices something yellow in the stream. And that's the beginning of the California Gold Rush. So, and it was, of course, clear proof to the Polk administration that divine providence approved of this whole enterprise, because not only do you take this fantastic port, which guarantees you strategic presence in the Pacific, but all of a sudden you've got this absolute eruption of gold coming out of the ground in California. Within 3 years, you have 250,000 people pouring in to California. Okay? It's unprecedented in human history. Okay? And it really has to do with a steamship. And basically, you can get from Europe and you can get from the east coast of the United States over to California, around the tip of South America, under steam power, which means you've got a better chance of surviving, way better chance. And you won't be blown off course for months at a time. And all of a sudden, it becomes possible and relatively economic to transport civilians. You know, you don't have to be a whaler. You don't have to be a fur trader. You know, actual planters, miners, farmers can get around the tip of South America, and they do. You also have some population disturbances at that point on the global scale, which cut loose a lot of people. You have the Taiping Rebellion in China, which is the bloodiest civil war in human history. There were a lot of Chinese anxious to start new lives elsewhere. You have the Irish Potato Famine, which took a population of 8 million and trimmed it by a million through outright starvation, and another million fled. And then there was the what we call the Revolution of 1848, which was a democratic and nationalist upheaval in Europe, which really tried to bring back some of the key features of the French Revolution, you know, the participation of the people in the government against the system of government, which was pretty heavy-handed, reactionary, basically monarchy in Europe. And they had a very exciting run, and then they lost badly. The monarchic governments took control again, and a lot of people in Germany and France and Italy found it very advisable for their health to try a new continent. The alternative was a firing squad. So we have this influx, and then you dangle in front of all these displaced people the prospect of walking around California picking up gold. Okay? This was a strong argument. And so they all came out here in what now seems to be fantastic ignorance, and they just wanted to get here. That's all. And it took a fair amount of money. I mean, not everybody can walk to California. It took a certain investment. But they got here, and they came in by the tens of thousands. And this remote colony, this really, really rustic place with 150,000 Indians and fewer than 10,000 Europeans, suddenly gets just crushed under a wave of footloose miners who are strictly interested in the gold.
There's an image in your book that of people would come here in ships, and then the entire crew of the ship would abandon ship and go into the mines.
Yes,
so there were
yes.
so many ships that were just derelict.
Yes.
They're still in the sediments of San Francisco Bay. They're still down there.
They are, hundreds of them. There's wonderful photographs, and this is a good point to mention T.J. Meekins, who helped me with this book. She's the image meister, and T.J. has scoured the archives in Washington and come up with a fantastic assortment of images. There's like 108 illustrations in the book. And so that's one of them. It was a treat to actually find one.
I'm speaking with Richard Hurley, the author of California and the Civil War, which is just published today, if I'm not mistaken. And sitting in for Haynes Ely, thank you, Haynes, for giving me the spot. So, okay, so we have gold, and that's obviously we could devote at least one program just right. to the gold rush. But yeah. let's look at the demographics after people have been pulling gold out of the hills, out yeah. of the streams. And you've got all these people from all over the world, but you also have a lot of Americans.
Right.
And you've got Americans from the north and Americans from the south.
Right.
Essentially, California was more or less a border state.
It was. It was very much so. And people don't really understand that, because if they know anything about California, it is that California sided with the Union, and maybe they know that the Californian gold was important to the Union economy, and that's about it. Or maybe they look at a map online and they say, oh, California voted for Lincoln. It must be a northern state like all the others that voted for Lincoln. And boy, is that not the case. We had in 1860 a four-way presidential election, and the votes in California, I think, give you a pretty good idea of who was out here and where their politics lay. Lincoln won California's electoral votes, it's true, but he got less than a third of all the votes cast. In California in 1860.
And his name did not show up in the South.
There were two separate elections that happened to be in the same year. In the North, it was Lincoln versus Douglas, and it was in the South, it was Breckinridge versus Bell. And just to briefly explain that, the Republicans, represented by Lincoln, they don't like slavery, but they are anything but in favor of equal rights. The reality is that almost all white Americans at that period were white supremacists. But they really disliked slavery, and so the Republican Party is trying to limit the extension of slavery into the territories won from Mexico. And then the Democrats, who have been the dominant political party in the country, are split. And that's what gets Abraham Lincoln into the White House. The Southern Democrats run a guy called Breckinridge, who is a states' writer, very much in favor of draconian fugitive slave laws. He later becomes a Confederate general. So he's the Deep South candidate, but the Northern...
Draconian fugitive slave laws. In other words, the federal government would back you up and go after escaped slaves.
Right. And so when you hear people saying how the South was for states' rights, you need to qualify that. The South was in favor of states' rights, which helped slavery. And they were against states' rights, which allowed Northerners to ignore runaway slaves. And there was a great deal of resentment in the North about that. And that was compounded by the Dred Scott decision, which put the legal status of blacks in America in complete disarray.
Dred Scott was a runaway slave.
He was a runaway slave who went to a free area and then was brought back into a slave state where his master died. And abolitionist lawyers picked up his case saying that Scott should be free. It became quite the cause célèbre, and it got all the way up to the Supreme Court, which happened to be very Southern at that time. So you have Chief Justice Roger Taney issuing a decision on behalf of the United States Supreme Court, basically saying that blacks cannot ever be citizens of the United States, that they are property that can be bought and sold for the benefit of their owners.
And here, this would be a good time for you to make a really important point of why there was so much concern, why it was so important to Southerners for slavery to be legal and to be able to expand into other states. It's an economic system.
Yes, that's the real heart of the matter. In 1860, slavery was the largest single capital investment in the United States.
Capital investments, these days would be machinery.
Right, or infrastructure, transportation systems, airplanes, trucks, factories, whatever. The largest single investment in America at that time was human chattel. Okay? So the South's entire society is powered by that. You don't have to own slaves to be invested in slavery. All you have to do is be the minister in the local pulpit whose living is paid by the planters. Okay, you're directly being paid by slave labor in that case. If you own the newspaper that you sell to educated Southerners, they are writing their subscriptions out to you, and they expect to hear their system, the system that runs their plantations, vigorously supported. Okay? And there's another problem with slavery at this point, and that is that it is based typically on a monocrop system that is destructive to the land. So basically slavery rolls westward.
Talking cotton here.
Cotton, yeah. Cotton is, in fact, yeah, it's important to mention cotton because that is the heart of it. That's what generates the largest economic return on slavery, and it's very hard on the soil.
And which today, if I'm not mistaken, is the largest use of herbicides in this country, and pesticides.
It's a tricky subject, that cotton. It's a wonderful fabric that makes very nice shirts, but it causes a lot of deaths. Yeah. And so that's why the Southerners were so concerned. They needed to expand, or they felt they needed to expand. And they saw the attitudes in the country turning against slavery, just as the rest of the European world was turning against slavery. England abolished it in the 1830s. The French Republic actually had abolished it as part of the Revolution, although they waffled on that a little bit later on. But the general trend was obvious, and Southerners were very aware of European opinion on it. So they felt defensive. They felt surrounded, beleaguered. Interestingly, the South became more attached to slavery in the mid-1800s than it was at the time of the Revolution, simply because of the economic success of cotton, you know, where Jefferson and Washington both envisioned freeing the slaves and ending slavery. Their grandchildren were writing editorials about how important slavery is and how it was basically decreed by God as a favor to the virtuous white race.
Now, as we said, and as you said, California was essentially a border state where it had a large population of Northerners, large population of Southerners,
yes,
along with all the other folks who came in.
Yes.
And yet, before becoming a state, Californians together wrote a constitution, and it outlawed slavery.
It certainly did, and many people mistake that for belief in human rights. It was nothing of the kind. They also came within one vote of banning blacks from California. Okay. The story behind that is that mining is terribly hard work. Okay. And most people who came out here were individual miners. They might be part of a small company, but basically everybody was going to wield a pick and a shovel. And nobody wanted to compete with slave-powered mining companies. This was a very bad idea as far as they were concerned. Whether you came from the North or the South, you wanted to choke off the possibility of slave-powered mining companies in California because they had such a good chance of success. It's the kind of work that you can do with basically creating a small concentration camp and keeping people, you know, by the edge of the river washing gravel. So it was voted against by Northern and Southerners alike, but that, again, should not be mistaken for the idea that California was a free state. In fact, the very year after we adopted the Constitution,
that was 1849.
1849, yeah. In 1850, out comes the first California Indian law, which says, you know, we may not have black slavery, but we can do, you know, something pretty darn close to the Indian population. And so under that law, if you were an Indian who was not gainfully employed by a white or on a reservation, you were subject to servitude. The system started out having boys and girls assigned to white farmers, basically, and it turned out to be very successful. So the term of servitude kept lengthening. And by the height of the system, if you were a young Indian man, you could be held in servitude until you were 30 years old. If you were a young Indian woman, you were held in servitude until you were 25. If you were an adult who was captured in war, you were eligible for 10 years forced labor, whatever age you were. It was a horrible system. And you have to remember that the legal system of California at that time, such as it was, to the extent that it was vigorously white supremacist. So an Indian cannot testify in court. If you are an Indian and you are hauled before the local justice of the peace, some white person is going to have to go in there. And typically, if they do so, it's because they're saying that you, the Indian, belong to them, the white farmer, and, you know, lay off, he's my Indian. Other than that, the results of Indians going into court were very bad.
California applies for membership, applies for statehood in the Union 1850.
Right. Yeah, and an absolute firestorm breaks out in Washington. This is an almost unknown story, but the Civil War came within a hair of starting in 1850, and it was California that was going to start it. Because at that point, the U.S. Senate was divided evenly between the free and the slave states. And so the notion of a free state coming in was anathema to the Southern leadership. The dying John C. Calhoun, you know, the Southern prince of the Senate, gives his dying speech against California's admission. As a matter of fact, he can't even give the speech. He's too sick to get up. But he has the speech read, and it threatens war in so many words. If you bring California into the Union, we know what we're going to do. And it was
just leave.
And he, Calhoun in his private writing said that meant war. He understood that the North would not actually let the South go without a war. He was prescient in many ways. He also predicted when the war would start in terms of how many administrations away from that time. But he died before the war started. In fact, he died very shortly after that speech. So the nation is standing at the edge of the precipice in 1850. One senator waves a gun at another senator in the debate over this on the floor of the Senate. It's just mayhem. And there are three senators who put together this unbelievably complicated deal. Daniel Webster and, Clay. And I forget the third gentleman. Anyway, they were just magicians of the Senate floor, and they worked out this elaborate compromise, which kept the nation glued together for another decade.
The compromise of 1850.
1850, yeah. And basically it allowed the southern states to enjoy the full services of the federal government in hunting down slaves. Northern governments could be prosecuted for harboring slaves. Northern individual citizens could be prosecuted for harboring slaves. It was a remarkably cruel and extensive law.
And it brought California into the Union.
It did. That was the price. And, of course, the irony is that California comes into the Union and promptly joins the Southern Bloc in Washington. Okay.
This is where we get a famous duel.
We're coming to that. In fact, in 1850, nobody knows what's going on in California politically. But the reality is that Southerners at that time were just much better politicians. You know, my own theory is that they felt like they had more to lose, that the South was on the defensive and they needed as much control of the federal government as they could get. So California's state government falls into the hands of a guy called William Gwynn, who is a plantation-owning slave-owning Southerner from Mississippi.
And a very experienced politician.
Yes, he served as an aide to Andrew Jackson at one point, and he'd been through the whole political system. He knew how patronage worked to a fairly well.
Patronage meaning you find jobs for your friends.
Right. In fact, the customs house in San Francisco was known as the Virginia Poor House because any Southerner who was out of a job could just walk over to the mint and say, hi, y'all, I need a job. And Gwynn made sure that Southerners were treated preferentially. It's a remarkable story. He was the most powerful politician in the state through the 1850s, and he and his allies were known as the chivalry. They liked to think of themselves as representing an aristocracy. But they weren't the only flavor of Democrat to come out here. There were Democrats from the North who were very different people. There was one in particular called David Broderick, who was a young Irishman from New York.
Also a very experienced politician.
Very. And New York politics were different. They tended to be a lot more physical. The way you ran politics in New York was you would enlist the local fire companies and basically have gangs of political hoodlums to control the elections. This system has been since referred to as Tammany Hall. You'll hear that phrase quite a bit. And it was very rough and tumble. Broderick himself, oddly enough, was not personally corrupt. He didn't profit from this remarkably corrupt way of running a government. But he did like power. And so if you were, he moved out to San Francisco and he figured out that people needed to make money if they wanted to be politically important. So he started taking gold dust from miners and he would mint it into coins and the coins would be worth more than the gold dust. And Broderick kept the difference. And the coins were useful and it was a good thing for the miners because the coins, everybody knew, you know, what that was worth. You didn't have to weigh it out. But, of course, the difference between the gold you brought in and the dollar that Broderick minted for you was a lot. So Broderick makes a fair amount of money. He gets into politics, and he basically takes over San Francisco and runs it the same way that New York City was run. And so elections had less to do with, you know, counting who was in favor of what politician and more about who had physical possession of the ballot box. And it was the roughest, most corrupt urban government in the United States, to the point where you actually had open warfare on the streets. This brings you into the whole vigilante Surrey. You know, and you have armed groups contesting for the control of San Francisco. But Braddock rises above all that, and he becomes a state political figure. He finally becomes the U.S. Senator from California in 1857, if I recall correctly. And he is a young Irish working class man, and he doesn't care for slavery. In fact, his father was a stonemason. And the kind of opprobrium that Southerners handed out for physical labor was offensive to Braddock. He felt keenly his lack of education. You know, he knew he wasn't as polished as someone like William Gwynn. He tried to pull the Democratic Party over to the Free Soil faction that was in play at that time.
Free Soil meaning that as states come into the Union, they will be free or slave states.
Right, and he wants free states. He wants the territories conquered by Mexico to come in as free states. And, of course, this is very offensive to the chivalry in California. And a very sour atmosphere starts building up in the Democratic Party to the point where you have physical violence. And the ultimate statement of that violence happened in 1859 when a man called David Terry, who was the Chief Justice of the California Supreme Court, decided that David Braddock had done him wrong in the last election. Terry lost his election to the Supreme Court. And so he blamed the Northern Democrats in general and Braddock in particular. And they started trading insults. And you didn't do that in those days without some peril. So finally, the challenge is issued. Terry challenges Braddock, and Braddock agrees. And they meet near Lake Merced on the peninsula, and our Chief Justice shoots and kills our U.S. Senator. I must say that this wasn't all that unusual in California at the time. We led the nation in deadly encounters, right? It was the code dueller was big out here. And so there had been other duels in the legislature. But this one finally got people's attention.
Well, possibly the pistols were fixed.
There's a great deal of debate about that. Braddock did definitely end up with a hair trigger pistol that went off as he raised the gun. Braddock was an expert shot, an absolutely fearless man physically. He'd proven that as a firefighter and as a street fighter. He was just, you know, he was not worried by physical danger. And Terry was very much the same sort of character. So they were both there willing to fight to the death, but Braddock never had a chance. His bullet goes into the ground, Terry's bullet goes into Broderick's lung. And 3 days later, Braddock is dead. The impact of this on California is enormous. Okay, people out here, I mean, think of it, you're out here to get rich. If the Southerners want to run the state government, that's fine. You know, let them, because what matters to me is my claim and getting my gold down to San Francisco. I had the feeling that most Californians were more loosely attached to politics than, say, people back east, because they had a lot of other things on their mind. But when you have your elected officials killing each other within the same party over the slavery issue, then people start saying, wait a minute, you know, this is not viable. And so at that point, the Democratic Party splits. And in 1860, when the terrible crisis breaks out back east and Lincoln is elected and the southern states go out, in California, you actually have a divided Democratic Party in the same way that you had it nationally. So you began to have Northern Democratic candidates for office and Southern Democratic candidates for office. And then you had this little upstart group called the Republicans, who had been beaten to a pulp in the 1856 elections and suffered badly in the 1859 elections. Leland Stanford, their candidate for governor, got 10% of the vote, right? So it's a fringe group. But after that Broderick-Terry duel, Californians began to say, wait a minute. And so they began to look at the Republican Party a lot more seriously. And so when the war broke out and the state government was very much up in the air, and it was run by Southern Democrats, and the recently elected governor was a member of the chivalry, literally nobody knew whether California was going to go out with the South. Jefferson Davis was firmly convinced that it would. The people around him said, it's a sure deal, don't worry about it, because the entire California congressional delegation belonged to the chivalry. And, of course, Lincoln looks at the California results, and he sees, hey, I won. And the guy who came in second was actually Stephen Douglas, and he's staying with the Union, you know. So actually, it was basically a three-way tie in California between Lincoln and Douglas and Breckinridge, the southern candidate. But if you add that up, it's clear that there is a northern majority in California if it can be harnessed. And so the question is, can the northerners get it together to take control of California before bad things happen out here? And the bad things were just on the brink of happening. In particular, the U.S. Department of the Pacific, the military district that California's in, is run at that time by a general by the name of Albert Sidney Johnston. And he is one of America's most distinguished soldiers. He, like many of the top Army brass, is a Southerner. And like most of them, he's against secession. But when Texas goes out, and he claimed Texas as his home state, Johnston felt like he had no choice but to resign. And so he very reluctantly comes to that decision, and he does resign. But if he had chosen instead to start an insurrection out here, he later writes to his family, so you know, he's not issuing propaganda, he writes to his family, that he could have taken his officer corps with him. And when you are working in a state with 28% Breckinridge voters, that is to say committed Southern Democrats, and you have a general of the capability of Sidney Johnston, you've got yourself a serious war in the Missouri or Kansas level for the asking. No question about it. Johnston could have done it.
Okay, you just brought up Missouri and Kansas. We don't have a whole lot of time left. So we obviously are going to have another show on this to really get into this. We haven't even started this.
Nobody shot anybody yet except for Broderick. Yeah.
Right. So in our last five-plus minutes, how should we wind this up and entice people to listen in again sometime in the near future?
Oh, well, just tell them the stories are hardly started.
Yeah, really.
What happened was Californians who were interested in saving the Union, they all volunteered in large numbers, and then they got the whole thing switched on them. They were sent out to go deal with the Comanche and the Shoshone. They replaced the entire U.S. Army in the West. And so all these young Unionists who were, you know, so patriotic and want to save the country find themselves in the middle of Comancheria dealing with very irate Comanche and Kiowa warriors and, you know, outnumbered sometimes 10 to 1. So there's a lot more story to come.
Interesting there. Yeah. So, okay, so what happens when, is it Fort Sumter, I believe, is fired on and the Civil War begins? What happens in California?
People are running around terrified because there just is no precedent for this. You have a governor who is a member of the chivalry, and nobody knows whether he's going to try to keep California in the Union or not. It's fortunately for California, this man, John Downey, 32 years old, Irish immigrant, you know, a real California story, just comes out of nowhere and becomes governor of the state. And somewhere deep in his soul, he decided that he was going to stay with the Union. He was a racist. He was, typical, in his attitudes, but he committed for the Union. And so, Union troops, California volunteers, they begin to enlist, and the War Department authorizes the raising of troops in California. The San Francisco merchants are terrified, and they are busy writing letters to the War Department saying, please don't send the regular troops away from here because the secesh are everywhere. And the War Department agrees. So the regular army is left in California until the Californians are able to undertake their own defense against internal insurrection. And that's basically the story of 1861.
Internal insurrection being Southerners.
Southerners. Los Angeles was firmly committed to the South. In fact, Sidney Johnston retired after he resigned. He went down to Los Angeles to retire, but he couldn't turn down the appeal of the South. So he enlists in the Los Angeles Mounted Rifles, which is a secessionist militia unit, and they ride across the Southwest in June and July of 1861. Okay, this is not a good idea. If you're going across the desert, you don't shoot for June and July. And you try to avoid the Apaches and the Comanches and all those people. But they just ride through the whole business, including patrols, U.S. Army patrols who are out to find them. And they ride from Los Angeles to Mesilla, which is at the end of Texas, and then onward. And Sidney Johnson then goes on to become the general who dies on the field at Shiloh, having come within a hair's breadth of destroying General Grant and his army.
Let's call that a wrap.
Okay.
And Richard, that is really fascinating. The book is California and the Civil War. You are going to be... I've attended some of your slideshows. What are you doing as far as putting this out?
Well, I've got a little launch here of a nonprofit called California Educational Multimedia. And, in fact, if you want to see it online, you just go caleducationalmedia.com. And I have put...
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Dot?
Oh, dot org. Thank you, Alan. Whew. Yeah, and so I want to get organized about my multimedia presentations. TJ and I have worked in multimedia, in our day jobs, and so we have the skill set. So when we give historical lectures, we use a lot of visual aids, animation, color slides, and such. And I want to promote the book by giving these lectures, multimedia shows, and we also have an exhibit that we created for the Folsom History Museum on this subject, which had toured recently. It was up at the Rood Center in Nevada County a couple of years ago. And so I've lumped all that together under the aegis of California Educational Multimedia. And I guess I'll be on the road talking to people and selling books.
Sounds real good. Yeah. I'm going to podcast this program in the next day or so, and I'll put up your website, the link on the podcast. Why don't you just give it to us again, though?
Yeah, I appreciate that, because Terry says it hasn't hit Google yet. Google doesn't know about it. So it's caleducationalmedia.org. And you get to see, and actually I've got some of the stories. I've got a history page up there. So if you want the details on Sidney Johnson's march to Mesilla, they're up there. And I've got a lot about a guy we haven't even mentioned today called Thomas Starr King, who's probably the best story in the book.
And it's funny because spent a fair amount of time in the Sierra, and there's a mountain called Star King. And it never occurred to me to look him up and who the heck is this guy. So that was very interesting.
Yeah, good. I'm glad. Yeah. The more people who know about Star King, the happier for everybody. He's a wonderful man.
Well, Richard, thanks very much. We will do this again in the near future.
My pleasure, Al.
I'm speaking with Richard Hurley, the author of California and the Civil War. And again, his website is caleducationalmedia.org. I'm Al Stoller. I've been sitting in for Haynes Ely here on Earth Mysteries.